der Marketing Transformation Podcast mit Erik Siegmann.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Marketing Transformation Podcast. Heute mit einem ganz besonderen Gast wieder zum zweiten Mal. Aus meiner Sicht einer der schlauesten und unternehmerisch erfolgreichsten Menschen aus der Advertising-Agentur-Szene. Welcome, Sir Martin Sorrell. Sir Martin, good to have you again.
I wish I understood what you just said.
I'm happy to repeat that in English. In my personal view, you did understand. Your German is, you have a kind of a comprehension of the German language, don't you?
My Yiddish gives me a good comprehension.
I remember. So I'm happy to repeat it. In my personal view, you're one of the smartest and the most successful entrepreneurial human being alive in media advertising.
I wish that was true. Anyway,
good to have you again. Last time we spoke was almost 1 year ago, exactly 1 year ago, I think. Many things happened. I just wanted to have your perspective, of course, a little bit a review on your your company, an analysis of the status quo of the industry, and of course, most importantly, a preview on what's up. So, Martin, how has the year been for you?
Well, if I look at the top line, Eric, it's been outstanding. I mean, we haven't released our full year results, but you know, for the 9 months, our net revenues, that's our gross profit. On a like-for-like basis, on a reported basis, was through the roof, I think over 50%. But on a like-for-like basis, was up 28% for the first 9 months and 29% in the third quarter. So no complaints on the adoption of our business model by clients. I mean, we now have, or will have by the end of the year, 10 major clients. We call them whoppers, which are clients generating in excess of $20 million of revenue a year. Our total revenues for this year are forecast by analysts to be about $1.2 billion. So from a zero start 4 years ago, I mean, that's an outstanding result. We have 50% of our revenues in tech. We have about 70% of our revenues North and South America, 20 in EMEA, 10% in Asia. We have about 60% in content, digital advertising content, 30% in data and analytics and digital media, and 10% technology services, which is technology transformation. As this podcast is about marketing transformation, that's highly relevant. You know, our biggest client is Alphabet. Our second biggest client is NDA, but it's a very famous, one of the most valuable telecoms tech companies on the planet. Then Meta, then BMW and Mondelez, then HP, then an NDA'd FMCG, an NDA'd financial services company. That's the top eight. And then we go to five companies, which are getting to the whopper status, either at the whopper status or getting to it: Amazon, Walmart, T-Mobile, Disney, and PayPal. So you get an idea from that. The traction on the model, which is a digital-only model, which is a data-driven model, which we go to market as faster being agility, better being an understanding of the digital ecosystem, and more efficient than, say, the traditional analog model. And then finally, we go as a unitary brand, Media Monks, which is what what our operating brand is called. So from a top line perspective, really moving well. 9,000 people now in 32 countries. We were 33, but we pulled out of Russia for the obvious reason. And we have about 60 offices in those 32 countries. So no complaints from that. From a process point of view, we had our challenges around audit delays and profit warnings. But actually, the full year results, as you will see in due course in, when we announce them in March, you know, have been strong.
Yeah.
And so we've got our together, not just around the top line, but the bottom line too. So the answer to your question is, I think overall, 22, despite all the challenges, you know, the huge challenges that we've had, you know, as a company, a country, a continent, globally, I mean, all the things, you know, we started when we were talking this time this year, last year, maybe it was the end of last year, just we kept at the end of 21, you know, we didn't really have any knowledge of the steep rise in interest rates or inflation or the war or the continued degradation of US, US-China relationships. Russia, we knew was an issue, but we didn't know it was going to be as big an issue, despite the fact that President Putin, you know, had been talking that way really since about 2002 in one way or another. I suppose his thinking really developed when he was on his own in the COVID period in St. Petersburg or Moscow, wherever he was. And then last but not least, the problems in Iran, quite not forgetting North Korea and the Middle East more generally. So the world is beset with big issues. We'll get on to it when we talk about 23. But I think all in all, given all the challenges we had in 22, we did well.
Yeah, no doubt challenging circumstances from a macro and a micro perspective. Your business model is, of course, well, as far as I can understand or see it, is attracting especially a new breed of advertisers. And you mentioned it on your top client list. So there's, if I'm not mistaken, do you have a kind of a concentration of tech close to tech advertisers? Do you see it the same way, like Meta and Alphabet?
We focus on tech. We have a 50% of our business is tech.
Yeah. Probably. But
I think it reflects a broader trend, Derek. Actually, I think, you know, the way the world going, and it's not something that people like to hear in our industry or the traditional parts of the industry. But if you look at consumers and, you know, if you look at what we do, what you and I do as consumers, I mean, our attention spans are much shorter. We're much more promiscuous from a brand point of view than we were historically. I mean, brand loyalty has shifted. And we're much more attuned, you know, we're bombarded with communications and messages every second of every minute of every hour of every day of every week of every month of every year. And it's a difficult environment. And I think the techniques that are used by tech clients, you know, I haven't mentioned Netflix, you know, we have a big relationship with Netflix, but the sort of relate or Disney Plus or Univision, the sort of techniques that they use, which are data driven. And you see this happening with the car companies, you see this happening with FMC. It's been accelerated by the IDFA changes and the deprecation of third-party cookies. But the use of first-party data together with signals from the platforms is critically important. Now, these are things that the tech companies have been doing for years. They haven't had analog systems. They haven't had the problems of pulling them together. So when you say, you know, well, we do a lot, you know, new type of advertiser, and you say tech, I think it's a new type of advertiser, but it's not confined to the tech industry. Those techniques are techniques that everybody, you know, in a number of industries, you see clients going direct to consumer for the first time. You know, instead of having dealers or instead of having intermediaries, they're being able to build databases direct to the consumer. You know, you see this most sharply in the car industry. What is Tesla? really is a computer on wheels. And then you think about what he's doing in the space environment with SpaceX. You think about, you know, the implication. Twitter is maybe a slightly different story, but you see, you know, in essence, he's building a sort of tech ecosystem, and cars are no longer cars. They're sort of software on wheels or computer on wheels. And you can link those cars and link those devices in new ways. So everything is being driven by digital transformation. And so it's not tech. It's a new type of advertiser. We'll get on to what I think is going to happen in 23 and 24, which I think embodies or sort of is an emblem, an icon of what we're talking about here. But it's not really tech. It's a new type of a new approach. And I think many in our industry are dreadfully uncomfortable with it because they're comfortable with big brand films, you know, to use the extreme, which take 3 months to produce, and have got to be done perfectly. You know, we're in a business which is continuously evolving on a second by second basis, 24/7 basis, and you're having to continuously adapt. So agility, you know, when we talk about faster, better, more efficient, agility is absolutely key.
Yeah. I totally get your point that your company is based on this paradigm shift of how media advertisers and target groups are interacting on data. But the probably you would agree that the average FMCG company is adopting this new paradigm not as fast as the tech savvy companies, so those who are going to direct. And if that would be the case, now we have this situation that enterprise values have been coming down, especially more importantly in the tech sector than in other industries. Did that affect your business? And if so, for the better or for the worse?
Well, you know, you say that. You know, it is true. The reason why FMCGs or autos or whatever have not been able to adapt as rapidly as new entrants who haven't had the analog structure is because of the analog structure. You know, if you have, you're a retailer and you have thousands of retail outlets dotted around the globe and consumers are increasingly buying merchandise online, it does take periods to adapt. You have an analog system, which is, so it's naturally going to be slow, but that doesn't reduce the importance of making the shift. And the shift might be omnichannel. I mean, it's not either or, it's a mixture of the two things. But you're starting to see shifts in industries, which are very fundamental, you know, where hitherto there have been dealer distribution networks, where manufacturers now, because consumers are ordering direct from the factory or because they have direct connections to the factory or in their product, there are chips which or apps that connect them directly to the manufacturer. You know, the irony of that, the advertising was created originally to go over the heads of wholesalers and retailers to the consumers by manufacturers. Yeah. Manufacturers now can reach those consumers directly through digital communication. So the game has shifted, the world has shifted, and the nature of advertising has shifted. And whereas you used to do it over the heads, you're now doing it directly because you have a direct connection. So I think, you know, the answer to your question is if those companies are not moving fast, they have to move faster. It's not black and white, by the way. It's not either or, because, you know, it is true that in certain products and services, there will always be, for example, a retail component. But, you know, what's interesting about your question, you take the retailers, look at the growth of the walled gardens that the retailers themselves are trying to, you know, whether it be Walmart or Walgreens or Target, you know, in order to deal with Amazon, what are they doing? they're using their data. You know, you take Publicis did a joint venture with Carrefour using their data, really basically to develop their walled garden. That's pretty smart.
The retail media industry from a retailer's perspective, sure.
Yeah, so I think it would be a mistake to say, you know, these are tech advertisers and they're doing it because it's tech. Everything is tech. You know,
sure.
with all the threats that we have and problems that we have, you know, if you want to be optimistic, it's like on the energy side, nuclear fusion, that experiment that was successful in America a few days ago. Everybody's saying we'll have cheap energy, fossil-free energy, fossil fuel-free energy in some point in time. It'll take 15 to 20 years maybe. So everybody gets excited about technological advances. It's affecting everything that we do. So it would be a dreadful mistake for any FMCG or retail or auto or whatever company to say, it's not me, it's tech. Because everything is, so it underpins everything we do. So what we're doing with those companies is really advancing. And the answer to your question is there has been no change. I mean, those companies, despite the falls in EVs, despite the falls in valuations, in multiples, which is a natural result of interest rates rising, despite all that, their focus on data-driven communication, whatever the industry might like or might not like about it, that's the way it's going. That's the way it's going. That's the way and agility. I mean, I think the biggest issue is not, you know, whether we're a tech firm or not a tech firm. I mean, everybody is. The biggest issue is agility. Yeah. I mean, the unwillingness of organizations, particularly in good times, to make changes, human nature being what it is, when times are tough is when you make changes. When times are good, you don't. And that's I think, the mistake. So I think the pace, the agility issue is key. And you know, companies have structures, they have politics with a small p, and they have habitual ways of doing it. And by the way, also to be fair, the people who run companies want results in the short term. Certainly the investors do, and the senior management. So the focus of an organization tends to be on the short term rather than the long term. And I think that's a big problem. You know, I think the reason why the Mittelstand, you know, we were talking before this podcast about what was happening in Germany, and you made the interesting comment, you thought that the Mittelstand had sort of adapted well to current economic conditions. And I think the reason is, in part, that family-run businesses do take the sort you find that are so strong in Germany, for example, do take a long-term view and do adjust their businesses in a much more fundamental way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the German Mittelstand is probably not as obvious in its, well, especially not outside of Germany, but I think it's a very strong pillar many advertisers being held independently from capital markets or short-term perspectives are quite performing very good. That what we've been discussing before that. But I think that's a good point to talk a little bit of Germany. Last time we spoke, I thought I have the feeling that you're pretty bullish about the German market. I thought I would sense some appetite for M&A on the German market. Everyone knows that agencies have been on the market or still are. What's your view on Germany 12 months later?
I think if I look at our first 9 months and what I know to be for the first 12 months, you know, EMEA, ironically, will be our fastest growing region. So, you know, we've done well, as you know, the overall.
What is that ironically?
Well, it's ironic because if you look at the world, you know, and if we were to sort of say, where do we think growth is going to be strongest? Is growth strongest? We would say North and South America, the Middle East, Africa, Asia Pacific, China, Europe, given the war, we would say Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and the UK all challenged. So, so you know, we've done very well. So the answer is, you know, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and the UK have done well for us this year. And I think will continue to do well for us despite a very difficult environment. And the answer to your question is that Europe, despite, you know, the conversation that we had again before we started this podcast, where you were, you know, optimistic about certain parts of the German economy, despite the pressures it was under, obviously the energy costs being the most extreme, you know, logically, if you look at stock markets, if you look at forecasts of growth, if you look at inflation, Western Europe is the toughest part of the world, you know, without a doubt. And the easier parts of the world will be the other parts of the world that I just referred to. So I remain, you know, we are still, from a company point of view, 20% is EMEA. We can argue that that's the right level, but I think we're still subscale in a European context, not just Germany, but France and Italy and Spain and the UK. So we have to grow. On deals, you know, because of the issues that we had to face this year, we focused more on organic growth. And when you're growing at 28, 29%, and you're saying to the market, you will grow by a minimum of 25% this year. And then next year, we haven't given guidance, but most people expect us to grow. I think the analysts are averaging forecasts for us for around 15% at the moment. When people are expecting you to grow at that sort of level, I mean, that's pretty strong growth. I mean, how many agencies in Germany have grown by that sort of growth? There are very few, if any. So the paradox here is, given the economic situation for us, the paradox is, you know, we continue to grow extremely strongly in EMEA. And when I look out, I mean, I have to be blunt with you. I'm very worried about the war. I'm very worried that it will continue for a long period of time. It's one of those wars, like you know, I think the Russians were in Afghanistan. What was it, for 10 years?
Yeah.
You know, it's not within the realms of possibility that continues to be the case. We can't, you know, President Zelensky was in Congress, you know, asking for more weapons yesterday and for more support, you know, because of the Ukrainian military success. It's unlikely, and didn't sound yesterday, he's willing to compromise in terms of any negotiations. The Russians are similarly entrenched. So it looks to me as though we're going to continue to have this, and that's not a pretty situation for Germany. Whilst we seem to have managed okay with natural gas supplies and oil this year, that's not the real issue, because we've built up reserves. It's what's going to happen next winter if the war continues. So, you know, again, I don't want to be too depressing, but the economic scenario is very different, very difficult. And when you see, you know, Germany and the moves that were made with China just recently, which, you know, which I support, which I think is the right thing to do. I think communication and trade is the way to deal with this fragmentation. If it's not deglobalization, it's certainly de-emphasizing globalization and more fragmentation and fractionalizing, and it doesn't help. I mean, the fundamental issue is U.S.-China relationships and U.S.-China. You know, it's a bipolar world, and the world in 2050 is going to look very different. You know, Indonesia might be even bigger than Germany, according to certain economic. You know, you'll have India, and you have China, US, India, Indonesia, Germany is the one of the in the projections for 2050 that I saw recently. So, you know, Germany will always be an important economy, but in terms of growth, I worry, given the current political climate. So it's very difficult, very difficult. Yeah. But, you know, to answer your question full on, we did well in Germany this year. We're forecasting another good year next year and beyond. Always could do better. But the model does resonate, and the model has attributes to it, as we've discussed, which are very much more orientated towards the modern economy. But having said all that, you know, the geopolitical pressures on Western Europe, and, you know, the UK is going through huge disruption at the minute, political strikes. You know, we probably next election in 2 years' time, the government will change color and be a Labour government. Whether they'll have a majority or not, or whether they'll have to have a coalition, we'll have to see. But, you know, it's not an easy situation. Not an easy situation.
I could go on forever with your point of view and your observations on a macro level. I need to ask a micro question again. Sure. Forgive me. I'm just realizing that talking of the M&A possibilities, and you said you've been growing organically because of that issue you had. You mean the delay of the audit reports? Yeah, did you ever internally calculate for you how much that hiccup did cost you?
Yeah, it in reported results, it was less than 1% of revenue and less than 5% of profits. But of course, market value, it had a significant impact.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah, but market value, it had a significant impact. But, you know, we're interested in the long term, not the short term. So it's a question of building back better. But as I said to you, you know, in terms of top line growth, we did extremely well.
Yeah, I get that. The competition. Last time we talked, you said your biggest competitor isn't any holding company or network. It is rather tech consultants like of the breed of Accenture and other. Did that change? How did that evolve?
No, it hasn't changed. I think if anything, it's got more so because, you know, we've started to get more into the digital transformation business. It's 10% of our business.
Yeah.
And it's the fastest growing part of our business. I mean, the organic growth rate has been well in excess of the average of 28% for the first 9 months. No, it hasn't. It's got more so. So you have those three levels that we talked about before. You have, you know, sort of Accenture, Globant, EPAM, Endava. There are others, but those are. Then you have bits of the holding company, you know, an AKQA or a VML or a huge, less so huge maybe, RGA, Wineman Kennedy. And then you have the specialists like an Oliver or a Jellyfish. So it's those three levels still, Eric. And I don't think that's changed dramatically. The holding companies, you know, on the surface have had, you know, they've grown this year by probably about 5 or 6 or 7%. Their net revenue equivalent to our 28% in the first 9 months and the 25% we said to the street for the full year. And they will probably grow by about 6 or 7% on average. And next year, as I said, the analysts are sort of saying flat for them because of the pressures on GDP. I don't think they are the real long-term competition because they still haven't. Their biggest problem is they still have an analog base.
Yeah.
Their analog base is still 60 to 70% of their business. So it's I think more difficult for them. You know, it's a bit like your question about, you know, retailers and FMCGs, you know, are they like tech companies? And it's exactly the same with the holding companies. They have to, and the market valuation point, I mean, you know, if I look at the valuation of the holding companies, for example, WPP, I mean, its market value, it's now slumped from, it was the largest. It's now the fourth largest, and its market value is probably equal to the separate value, the independent value of Group M, which is 40% of its revenues. So I think it'd be about 40%. So what it says is its market value is less than 40% of its revenues, which is quite bizarre. So you know, what the market's saying, Omnicom is now the most highly valued, then Publicis, then IPG, then WPP. But what the market's saying is, and again, it goes to the heart of your question about FMCGs and retailers, what the market's saying is they don't think the model has adapted quickly enough.
Yeah, I get it. Speaking of models, how do you judge parts of the business model of your for instance of WPP and others in regards to the media trading desk, the success of this world, those who tend to have a quite a significant part of the margin and profits. You could argue whether that can be still a growing business with advertising demand and for more transparency. How do you judge it now?
It's a good question. I mean, we S4 run a transparent model, so we don't, you know, we have an open book, and we've avoided since inception the closed model, you know, the discount. And you're right, because
you as the person that totally converted, I think you earned quite the other dollar or euro with that, didn't you?
It's a different era and a different time and a different execution. And but you're right. I mean, but it has defied the laws of gravity in that sense. But I think there's a much more interesting challenge coming. I mean, to your question, I think this is much more, you know, what we're going to see with AI and automation is the platforms develop more direct relationships. And, you know, the reason why, you know, everybody used to say that Google or Facebook would disintermediate the holding companies and would go direct. And the reason that they didn't was primarily they weren't service companies. If you looked at them and the number of employees they had, they didn't want to get into the service business. But with the AI and automation business, with the growth in that, and we're talking about next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the building of direct relationships. It's funny, you know, you asked me the question, and when I was in France a couple of weeks ago, it sort of noticed this most forcibly. You've already seen it in France. The P6, as they call it, which is the six holding companies, have a big position in traditional analog. The digital side of it is controlled. I shouldn't use the word controlled, but is affected by a series of digital independents who have a totally different model. Yeah. And if that in my mind is the forerunner of what we're going to see. So, you know, it may be that the holding companies and the Group M's and OMDs and Publicis Media can adapt, but they're going to be very challenged, because the platforms can go direct, not through the use of large numbers of, you know, armies of people, but just through AI and automation. That in my view is going to happen. And that, of course, for us is a massive opportunity.
Absolutely. Do you think that advertisers who aren't aware of the mechanism of trading desks, who can't or don't want to go direct, do you think that these advertisers are aware of the potential or the threat of intransparent trading mechanisms?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're a consultant, so. You must see and hear that. They must say to you, you know, Eric, can give me your view as to, you know, how much are we losing or not.
That's why I'm asking you. That's why I'm asking you, because it's a little bit like with a doctor. If you are healthy and everything is doing fine, you don't go to see the doctor. Of course, my impression is That many advertisers, no matter whether they are in an indirect or a direct-to-consumer business model, are quite getting more and more aware of the challenges with non-transparent inventory in digital, something they don't face in TV and out of home or
print. Yes, and that was exacerbated by the complexity of the digital supply chain, but that's being eradicated or being dealt with over time. I mean, look, it's quite easy, I think, for clients if they wish to go down the, let's call it the transparent route, to do so. They can hire they can hire us, and we can guide them. They don't even have to hire you. They can hire us. But we spend a lot of time looking at it. But I think what I was trying to get at was the nature of the system is going to shift. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen is that the mechanisms are going to change, I think, now.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously, I totally agree with you. Looking forward, how do you see pressure on budgets, pitches, larger investments into tech? Because of course, on the long-term perspective, I think no one would disagree with the importance and the overall trend. But on the short one and other crises, we've seen that investments in tech can be postponed. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, if we're talking about 23 and 24, which I think are the two difficult years where, you know, GDP growth when we started this year, you know, we thought it was going to be 4 or 5. We've ended up the year, let's say 2 or 3. Next year, 1.5 to 2, maybe 24, slightly better, 2 to 2.5. But this is certainly less than we've been used to in the last 40 years or last 10 years where we've been 3% plus. So the world is going to grow more slowly, and particularly so in 23, 24. I think the unlock will come with the American presidential election in 24, when, you know, if there's a shift to the Republicans, that is generally good for business. You know, I know that's a very simplistic way of putting it, but that's the way I would put it. I saw that, you know, whatever you think about President Trump, the simple fact is, when he was elected in 16, that was good for business because it was less regulation, less tax. And I think the same thing applies if DeSantis or even Trump, whether you think that's a good idea or not, probably more likely to be DeSantis now, given what's been happening. But there's a shift. I think we have to wait for 2 years. It's going to be difficult. In those 2 years, I think a couple of things are going to happen. One is, and we're already seeing it in the last quarter of this year, activation and performance becomes more important. You know, those companies that you and I were talking about before we started the podcast, the companies that are trying to manage their revenues and costs efficiently are going to do two things. One is they're going to make sure that their marketing budgets are generating sales. You know, they've been pricing up with inflation, they've been pricing up, but you can't keep on pricing forever. You have to, you know, modify that. You've got to look at volumes and what's happening. So they will be moving down the funnel, as we call it, to activation and performance, media mix modeling, return on investment. Those are the areas they're going to be looking at. That's one thing. The second thing is, which is to the heart of your question, I think next year, and we're already starting to see it with our digital. We had a review yesterday of our November results internally, and we were talking about this. We're seeing clients really focusing on digital transformation. This is the irony. You know, when times were good, they should have done it, but they didn't.
Yeah.
When times are difficult, they look for cost reduction. To your point, but you said to me you had clients asking you about that. One of the ways they can get that cost reduction, and it's not easy and it will be painful, is through digital transformation, is you know, eradicating the analog approaches and moving faster to a digital destination. And what we're seeing, I mean, I do think, Eric, there is a lot of delay at the moment. I do think a lot of clients have delayed finalizing their budgets. I'm not talking about their ad budgets. I'm talking about their operating budgets from which the ad budgets come. I mean, I can think of one or two companies who usually have completed their budgets for next year by October and still haven't finished them because of the uncertainty. They don't know what's happening on commodity pricing. They don't know what's happening on their product pricing. They don't know what's happening on some of the geopolitical stuff. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and that just breeds delay. On the other hand, you know, absent the holidays, when we had our management call as well yesterday, it was interesting. And I asked everybody how they felt about sort of the pipeline, and people feel pretty good about the pipeline. I mean, we see no great shift in the pipeline underneath it. You know, the fact that people are going on holiday for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever, or for the new year is one thing. But the underlying tone, because, and you know, with us, we're much more performance and activation orientated. I mean, we're very much down the funnel. We're not awareness and strategy. We get the job done and get the sales done and get the volumes done. That's what we do. Yeah. So I think that's what next year is going to be about, plus transformation. Again, on our call yesterday, the transformation people were saying they are seeing bigger take-up now. So I think there was some delay around budgets, but that's now starting to feed through the system.
Yeah. And on the media side of things, I assume that your clients don't need to have these year-over commitments like they used to have or they needed to have in analog times. Is that true? To give.
There's more flexibility in digital. There's no doubt about that. Mm. And I think, you know, look, I think the platforms have been blamed for every social evil, every political evil, you know, particularly poor old Facebook, Meta. And, you know, I think that's been overdone. I think Meta will do better next year. The comparatives get easier. I think, you know, going back to activation and performance, which are the platforms that offer better activation and performance? Google, Amazon. And you know, you're going to see big take up there. I mean, Amazon will continue to grow its ad revenues, I think, next year quite significantly. I think Google, you know, in Q3, Google did 11% up on search. So, you know, and Google still does what? They'll do 225 billion of ad revenues this year. Meta will do 115. Google did 205 last year. Meta did 115, so constant this year. And Amazon did 31 last year, 41 this year. So TikTok doubled outside China from 5 to 10 billion. They're the only one big breakthrough. And then ByteDance, their parent, I think is doing 60 billion of total revenues this year. And 90 is the forecast for next year. So look, these platforms are growing. This year they might have grown by, on average, the eight big platforms by about 10%. Next year we're looking at 5 to 10%, despite everything that's happening. So to your question, I think more money will shift. You know, I was with in Washington with a athletic sportswear guy, and he a CEO, and he said, you know, he's shifting all his money into digital and out of analog. So, I would say that, wouldn't I? Because our model is a digital model, but I do think that's the way it's going.
Yeah, excellent. Maybe next time we speak, maybe one Asian platform has surpassed Meta, or even maybe even Amazon is becoming the second largest Western platform. We will see that. Your appetite for M&A in Europe, is that growing, or you're focusing on organic growth?
We will always look, but I think we're very focused on organic growth at the minute. I think there are some opportunities in Asia. I think it is we're seeing it with clients. You know, clients who have big positions in China are saying, should we extend our positions in China beyond where we are now? And some of them, you know, are damping down. You see it in the flows of FDI and money. But, you know, places like Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, you know, I was on a call with India just before this. And, you know, India is a huge opportunity. So we still have an appetite for it. North and South America is still really interesting. The Middle East, huge. You know, Saudi Arabia grew by, 8.5% GDP. Vietnam grew by 13.5%. I mean, there are parts of the world, you know, I don't have to say this to German companies because German companies are expanding into these regions very, very, these countries very rapidly. But, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the holding companies because, you know, that you can make a big argument now. Maybe it's more with a WPP than it is with an Omnicom, but even true of an Omnicom, which is the most highly valued or in market value, the biggest value. These consolidations don't make sense anymore.
Yeah.
You know, what would make sense would be for them to be split. So, you know, you sort of see it with GSK. GSK split off Haleon. You know, it's consumer pharma business, separated it. You've seen it with other companies. J&J is splitting off parts of its company. So the fashion now is for deconsolidation. And if you look at the market values to your, you know, you've said a couple of times, EVs have come down. Well, yeah. The EVs of the holding companies don't make sense where they are at the moment.
Right. The enterprise value, yeah. The reason for consolidation was purchasing power, or what was the reason for consolidation at this time?
Well, yeah, it's a good question because, you know, in the analog world, you know, having the clout, you know, having the volume made sense. Yeah. In a digital world, it's brain power, not muscle.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good point, that the needs for it have changed. Having said that, and you mentioned about transparency, etc., those units, probably the media units have moved towards digital. They're not digital operations, but they moved towards digital quite quickly, or tried to, and they've tried to make the transformation. And, you know, on their own, you know, I just looked, you know, I think yesterday, Mediacom Essence won PlayStation globally. You know, was that because of any creative capability, or was that because, you know, that they were better on the media side? So could Essence Mediacom be better off on its own and not, you know, some part of some bigger operation? You know, what benefits do they get? And I think that is increasingly going to become the focus. You know, WPP's share price has fallen by 30%, by a third this year.
Yeah.
And you know, its market value has gone down a third. Earnings have gone up. Valuations, you know, it's valued probably at about 8x earnings this year. Next year, you know, if earnings fall, it'll be 10x earnings. But still, the simple fact is, if you took Group M, it's probably worth, I would say, somewhere between $10 and $15 billion, and WPP's market value is 11.
Get it? Yeah, we'll figure that out. Great. We're running out of time. That was really very insightful. I would love to continue. Before I let you go, Sir Martin, my my in, in in German would be my Abschlussfrage, my final question to you. You can answer it in on a professional basis or on a out of your private lives. What is your most important project for the future you haven't started yet?
Haven't started yet? Oh my God.
Yes.
Woof.
It's a little bit unfair because usually my German speaking guests do get a briefing, and in that briefing is a question. But I know that you are a communications professional.
I had hoped that England might get somewhere in the World Cup. So I think it was in 1966 when I was 21 years old, so it was 56, 57 years ago, but we lost on the World Cup, as you will remember, as people.
Yeah, in Germany, we will remember this.
I think that's probably the project that I would like. It's not something that I would start, but I had to wait at least another 4 years, and I doubt whether 4 years. I think at the end of the day, we just don't have the determination. When you look at the Argentinian victory, they wanted it more than the French at the end. I think that's the truth at the end of the day. It's a bit like the rugby when South Africa beat England in the World Cup final, the Rugby World Cup. It was clear that the South Africans really wanted it, from a historical basis and political basis. And I think we're not hungry enough. So I think I'm trying to desperately think of other projects. I mean, we're doing very well in the cricket at the moment. So we have a wonderful captain who you wouldn't know anything about. Ben Stokes. Those are the things I'm peripherally interested in. But there's no project that I would want at the moment. The projects that we have are all around S4.
They all started. Do you ever think about your succession? Is that something that crosses your mind?
Continuously. And if I don't think about it, everybody pushes me to think about it.
Oh, so goodness. How come? Very good. So, Martin, really, thank you so much. I wish you all the best. And hopefully we have the opportunity to continue our discussion in the next year.
Thank you very much, Eric. Loved it. Thank you.
Good time. Thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you very much. Is that okay?
It was really, no question. That was my podcast highlight of the year.
That must mean you don't have many highlights.
I have many highlights. This is my learning project. But I especially like the capability of yours to have a macro and a micro view as an entrepreneur, on an entrepreneur's side, on the business side, and on the macro perspective. So that's really something I highly appreciate.
Well, and I'd love to keep in touch. It'd be good to keep in touch. Yeah.
We'll do that. All right. Whenever you need something in Germany.
Those clients who want to reduce their costs, push them our way.
I will do that. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless
you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
God bless.
Bye.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars. Bei OMR.